Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 257, The Slippery Slope of Reality, Part 1, with Jerry Trumbull. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
If you've ever found yourself discussing science versus religion, and of course, my argument is, well, you know, religion is purely a belief. Science is not a belief. It's a methodology. It's a way of proceeding. And in truth, they're both belief systems.
That was the voice of my wonderful old friend and return guest, Jerry Trumbull, speaking about the religion of science. Jerry Trumbull, MS-ABD, and I have another one of our wide-ranging conversations. As usual, it's both personal and psychological. Among the topics we discuss in this first episode of what is going to turn out to be a three-part series is an article that appeared in the December 13, 2010 issue of The New Yorker magazine, titled, "Is There Something Wrong with the Scientific Method?" by Jonah Lerner. Jerry and I discussed this troubling article, which suggests that much of science may rest on a shaky foundation. This is Jerry's 14th appearance on Shrink Wrap Radio. The other 13 episodes were titled The Dave and Jerry Show, number one, number two, and so on. Jerry and I have led remarkably parallel lives. We met during our freshman year at the University of Pennsylvania and hit it off immediately. We were both there on scholarship. We both won scholarships through the U.S. Navy, but I didn't accept mine. We both began in electrical engineering. Independently, we both switched out of engineering into creative writing. Circumstances later forced Jerry to leave Penn after his freshman year, but we stayed in contact. Independently, again, we both ended up getting master's degrees in psychology and later getting into doctoral psychology programs, me at the University of Michigan and him back at the University of Pennsylvania. We did diverge in as much as I studied clinical psychology and he was into physiological psychology. There have been other parallels since those days, but I won't burden you with them. This background may help you to understand the comfort with one another that you'll hear in our conversations. Hold on to your hat, because here we go. Hey, Jerry Trumbull, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Dr. Dave, it's good to hear from you. It's been quite a while.
You know, it has been quite a while, and one of the things that I meant to do before getting on this call with you was to go back to the Shrink Wrap Radio website and see just how long it has been. Do you know?
No, but I did think about how long it's been since we first became friends.
Well, I've thought about that, too. Are you actually going to throw a number out there?
52 years.
Oh, I thought it was, wow. I thought it might even be more than that.
Well, 1958, so that would be 60.
No, maybe. it wouldn't be 50. Oh, yes, it could have been 58 or 59.
Yeah, 58, September. I think we met right off the bat when we were first freshmen at the University of Pennsylvania.
Okay, I have assiduously avoided letting the cat out of the bag as to my age.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
And you've just blown my cover.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Oh, well.
Yeah,
oh, well.
Really.
Well, we've both been getting pretty excited recently about some things that we've been reading and thinking about. And, of course, I've been wanting to get you back on the show for some time. And I had promised to do that, but then I was getting lured away by the siren call of famous authors. So I apologize.
No, I'll tell you, I have religiously listened to every episode of Shrink Wrap Radio, and I have found your recent work totally fantastic. Just let me tell you a brief story. The Jungian emphasis that you've had lately.
Yeah.
I always thought, oh yeah, Jung, whatever, you know. But right. But the it really piqued my interest. And then when recently you had a gentleman on who was talking about Buddhism and the Jungian influences, and you mentioned, or he mentioned, the movie that was available on Netflix,
right?
Called The Buddha.
Yes, and, yes, that was Mark Epstein, New York psychoanalyst and longtime authority on meditation.
Yeah, and so I immediately followed up and watched that movie, since I have Netflix. And, I, of course, had heard about Buddhism, but I had never really looked into it. And I was quite impressed with the story, and I decided that I'm actually a Buddhist.
Right. One discovers that, because Buddhist philosophy really, I think, appeals to intelligent people, if I may say so.
Yeah, and the fact that it has no God, mm-hmm. really impressed me. I thought, now here's something that doesn't have all this fancy paraphernalia about, something that's unknowable. And it had a major influence on my thinking, to tell you the truth. And I think your show does that to a lot of people.
Well, thank you. Hearing that from you is really important to me. I really value that. And enough of the backslapping, however.
Yes.
Let's get
down to business here.
We'll get down to business. And I've kind of titled today's discussion, the slippery nature of reality, because we're going to be talking about science and reality and consciousness and what do we really know and how do we know it. The place that I want to start is an article that appeared in a recent issue of The New Yorker, and I'm going to take a risk and actually put a copy of this article on the website so that our listeners can go to it. And I'm going to do it on the presumption of the educational slack that is given to in terms of copyright, since this is this show is on iTunes under Higher Education. So I'm going to take that liberty. So, folks, be sure to look for this article if you don't subscribe to The New Yorker, because you can't. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to get it online. It's called The Truth Wears Off. Is There Something Wrong with the Scientific Method? By Jonah Lerner. And this is in the December 13, 2010 issue of The New Yorker magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And so both of us read this article. I was really impressed by it because it's appearing in a mainstream magazine, The New Yorker, not an easy place to get published, as we both might know. I actually had the temerity to submit a short story or two back when we were undergraduates or not long after to The New Yorker. Did you ever do that?
No, I never did. I never took my creative writing seriously enough to do that. You, on the other hand, continued on. Was your undergraduate major in creative writing?
Yeah, it was. That's what it was.
Well, so there you go. That was a good thing for a creative writing major to do.
Attempt. Right, right.
Before we knew how the world worked.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to spend some time on this article, and then at some point, when I give the signal, we will segue into quantum mechanics and such that I know that you've been really interested in. Just to let the audience in on this, we had a little conversation just before getting on this call here. And Jerry wanted to go right into the quantum stuff, and I'm kind of hung up on this article. And
that's not to say that I don't think this article is important. The whole idea of science, the scientific method, In fact, that's the very first thing to talk about, is that science is based on a method. And it's the methodology that brings us to the, quote, truth, unquote. When you really get into it, you see that the truth has a probable level, a confidence level.
Right, right. And people have regarded the hallmark of scientific truth, quotes, as objectivity.
Yeah.
And I think what we're seeing, what we'll be discussing, is that the idea, the notion of objectivity, is it's got some problems.
Yes.
And related to that, getting into the article now, replicability has been considered to be the hallmark of scientific method. I'm sure you remember this from your long tenure of graduate studies, right?
That, yes, indeed. Yeah, that is it. That's it.
Yeah. And so what this author notes, and I was not aware of this, and I guess this is why I got excited about the article. I mean, yes, I've known that there have been, you know, that there's some questions about objectivity and about scientific method and so on. But what he talks about are declining statistical significance across a number of scientific disciplines. In other words, that initially results come out and there's some kind of fantastic phenomenon that's observed, and maybe it gets replicated and other people get the same thing or they don't, but that as time goes on, it becomes less and less replicable until either the effect, the initial wonderful effect, declines down to almost, you know, becomes a lot less than it was initially, or disappears down to zero.
Yeah.
And he talked about this happening across a number of scientific categories, if you will. For example, he talked about drugs. And one example he gave was second generation antipsychotics, such as Abilify and Zyprexa. You've probably seen the TV ads for Abilify.
Yeah, they make me laugh every time I watch them.
That's what I was going to say. What a name, you know.
Yeah, the names, and then that you need a drug to take in addition to the drugs that you're already taking to make them work better.
Oh, is that what it does?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Well, and just the name Abilify, you know, I thought on the one hand, it's sort of clever. You know, Abilify, like it's going to give you abilities. It's going to Abilify you.
That's right.
But then, of course, because the government makes them do it, you hear this litany of horrible side effects that can happen.
Exploding eyeball.
Yeah.
In rare cases, death.
Yeah, right, right. So it turns out that these heavily advertised drugs, the therapeutic power that was originally confirmed by research, has been steadily waning.
Mm-hmm.
And a recent study showed that it was 50% of the effectiveness of the initial trials that were conducted in the 90s. Now, that's shocking.
That is shocking. You would expect, and in fact, the one case they talk about, it was the same scientist trying to replicate his own work. That's where they start the article, I think. Isn't that correct?
I don't remember, but I think you're talking about Jonathan Schooler.
Right, exactly.
At the University of Washington. And they do spend a lot of time talking about him. And so this happens in medicine. It happens in relation to research on cardiac stents was one example given. Vitamin E studies was another one, and antidepressants, which he says have gone down in terms of their demonstrated effectiveness threefold in recent decades.
Totally amazing.
Yeah. So Jonathan Schooler, researcher at the University of Washington, he did research on something called verbal overshadowing, which I had never heard of, but basically it consists of, it describes an effect where people, the example that he It has to do with memory, and mm-hmm. that if you describe things that, if you describe your memories versus not describing them, what he found was that you remembered better. And he called that verbal overshadowing. For example, mm-hmm. people who described, who were shown pictures, if they described the face, then they had better recognition of that face later when they were shown it again than people who had merely seen it without describing it.
Mm-hmm.
And he extended that model to a variety of other tasks, such as remembering the taste of a wine or identifying the best strawberry jam and so on. And then he began having a problem replicating his own work.
Right.
And one of his mentors, this really got to me. So, you know, he talked to one of his mentors, somebody who he looked up to, and the mentor basically suggested that he stop trying to replicate it, saying, hey, you're just setting yourself up for disappointment.
Right, exactly. Just move on, I think is what he said.
Yeah, right, yeah. And so Schuller, though, he wasn't willing to move on. He couldn't quite let go of this notion, this shocking notion that seemed to imply that maybe perhaps all of science was on a rocky foundation. So he went, I don't know how he knew about J.B. Rhind's ESP experiments at Duke University, but he knew that Rhind had reported similar declines, that Rhind had gifted subjects. You know, he did these card guessing experiments. He had a special deck called Zener cards. And as I recall, I think there were 25 cards in the deck and five symbols there was a symbol on each card, and there were five different symbols in the deck. And, you know, and he would have people try to guess, okay, what's the next card going to be? And there were gifted individuals who did significantly better than others. There was one subject that he cites in this article who was right 50% of the time, mm-hmm. whereas you would expect a person to get it by chance 20% of the time.
Right.
So the odds of getting 50% of the time were many millions to one. But what Rhind observed was a gradual decline that eventually dropped down to the chance level. And this happened over and over again. And it's one of the reasons why ESP is still, you know, not in higher regard, because of the difficulty with replicability.
Right.
So Schuller, this guy Schuller at the University of Washington in 2004, he devised a precognition ESP test that's too complicated to describe here. And he observed the same thing. And the effect, the decline was worse than could be accounted for by something called regression to the mean. And maybe you can tell our audience what's meant by regression to the mean.
You think so?
This is a little curveball out of the blue.
Guess again, dude. No, I know that concept, but it's from the study of the financial world and stocks, and especially the price of precious metals.
Oh, yeah, something that you, quotes, dabble in successfully.
Yes.
Well, it's a statistical concept,
right,
that if you do lots and lots of studies or measurements, let's say, that they will cluster around the mean. I think that's what it means.
That's pretty close.
Something like that. That's close. That's sort of, hopefully my explanation regresses towards the mean of explanations about regression to the mean.
Oh, there you go.
Okay, moving right along, he talks about the research of Anders Mahler, a Danish zoologist, who in 1991 discovered something that he called fluctuating asymmetry. And this was an effect in his study of barn swallows. And he noticed that female barn swallows preferred symmetrical-looking male barn swallows. Mm-hmm. And measured this in terms of the length of the their feathers, so that if the feathers on the left side of, say, the tail and the right side of the tail were the same length, those male swallows were much more likely to get lucky than were. And so this is an effect that initially, you know, this generated a lot of excitement in zoology, and they've done these studies on humans and birds and all sorts of creatures. And everybody got very excited about this. So that over the next 3 years, there were 10 independent tests of the role of fluctuating asymmetry in sexual selection, and 9 of them found the relationship. But by 1994, the theory started to fall apart, with only 8 of 14 studies finding the effect. Then in 1995, only 4 of 8 found it. By 1998, only 4 of 12 studies found it. And between 1992 and 1997, the average effect size shrunk by 80%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a very good example of what we're talking about. It's like when you focus the spotlight on something and expect to get the same results, you don't always find that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems to kind of diminish over time and eventually fade away. So what does that have to say about the truth, quote unquote?
Yeah, you know, sometimes I've gotten comments, attacks from, quote, skeptics on the site. And, you know, sometimes I struggle with, you know, am I not skeptical enough? If I err at all, it's probably in the direction of not being skeptical enough. Sometimes I try to be a little bit skeptical, but, you know, I basically try to treat all my guests as respectfully as I can. And so that makes it hard to come out with a whole bunch of skepticism. But the skeptics sometimes are not sufficiently skeptical about science.
Oh, that is so true. That is so true. My experience, of course, 10 years of working at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research and working for NASA at the University of Maryland left me after 10 years as a total skeptic, because I saw so many different kinds of bias entering into these experiments. I saw the inflation of one idea into $1 million grants. I saw people actually cheating on their data. I mean, I mentioned one to you previously about work that I had done, and then I presented it, and then I was attacked personally by a guy who was well known in the field, and I don't know what his problem was, but I began to see science in a new light. You know, as a novice, I thought it was the pure essence of truth. And
you were formidable, because I was in clinical psychology, which is very soft.
Yes,
you were in the quote hard science branch of psychology,
right?
And at that time, you know, you were a true believer, and as I say, you were formidable in your arguments.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, since we began kicking this around, I did a little further research into a study that I remembered that undermined much of the work done by Skinner. And you'll recall back in those days, I was a dyed-in-the-wool Skinnerian.
Yeah.
And had rats pressing levers and pigeons pecking at little keys. Most of Skinner's work, in fact, his giant volume, Skinner and Furster, I think, were the authors, Schedules of Reinforcement. It's a big, fat book that contains all of these parameters for pigeons pecking on a key in a little chamber.
And it was kind of the Bible, right, of
yeah, it was,
behavior.
Yeah, it was the Skinnerian Bible. And that work was all called into question years later, when it was discovered that the pigeon peck was not a pure operant response. Indeed, it was part of a reflex and had a classical component as well. And for listeners who want to pursue this, I would refer them to Barry Schwartz, who was actually at the University of Pennsylvania when I went there as a graduate student. He was a year or two behind me, and he's gone on to subsequently do some interesting work. I think he even has a talk on TED. But Barry Schwartz did the first work to show that the actual response was contaminated by these two components, classical and operant at the same time. And that put all of this previous work of Skinner into doubt as to what it was really all about. Now, since that time, I haven't followed up on it. I don't know where that's all gone. But the pure, crisp science of the early operant conditioning days is long gone, mm-hmm. and has kind of devolved into a more of a mushy science than I would prefer. And in part, that was one of the reasons in my own career I shifted into physiological psychology, because I thought, okay, here's something we don't even have to talk about. We can talk about electrical potentials rather than operant responses. We can measure these with instruments, oscilloscopes and such, and we can be very precise in our measurements. And that's, I mean, I've been drawn to that kind of science throughout my life. But now, of course, we discover that even that is starting to go mushy.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're almost there. I haven't quite given the signal.
Okay. I was trying to lead into
it.
Yeah,
I could tell. I could feel the segue coming on.
Okay.
But I'm compulsive. And
Go on.
Just a little bit more on this New Yorker article. He talks about Michael Ginyans at the Australian National University, who looked at 44 meta-analyses. And a meta-analysis, of course, is like a overview of a whole bunch of studies on a topic.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a review. And so he looked at 44 conglomerations of research, if you will, and discovered a consistent decline. But this guy, Michael Ginyans, according to the author of the New Yorker article, refuses to discuss that publicly, because he says it's quotes, a sensitive issue for science.
I would guess so.
Yeah. And, the author points out that this problem of decline is not only in the pharmaceuticals, which are influenced by big pots of money. So there's a big source of bias right there, but also these declines show up in such disciplines as psychology and ecology. And so he cites the work of an Ioannidis, who looked at 432 studies on the genetic causes of schizophrenia, because there was kind of a fad at the time that, there's a genetic component here. Mm-hmm. And so there were 432 studies on the genetic causes of schizophrenia, and he discovered serious flaws in these studies. And when they looked at replications, only one of the 432 was consistently replicable. And so Ioannidis has written a paper titled, "Why Most Published Research Findings Are False."
Wow, yeah, that's a pretty definitive statement.
Yeah, really, really. So the author, the New Yorker author, makes the point, it's difficult to prove anything. And quotes, "When experiments are done, we will still have to choose what to believe." And I think that's interesting. And so just to wind up this part of our discussion, we can go through, what's the cause of this? What kinds of factors might be at work here? And so I sort of pulled out a list of them, and you can feel free to jump in and comment on any of these that you wish to.
Sure.
One is unconscious bias.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a whole bunch of research on that. Was there something called the Rosenfeld effect? I don't know. I'm reaching way back trying to remember this, but there was some research that showed that And this is sort of what led a lot to double blind studies and so on.
Exactly.
That's why they have to do double blind studies, is because they discovered this effect of unconscious bias.
Right.
But then we have, as you suggested, I mean, there's conscious bias and even out and out cheating.
Right.
And
more common than you would imagine, in my experience.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to realize that a particular scientist probably has written a grant application to get money to do the work, probably with a government agency of some sort, and has made the best possible case for doing that research. And then $1 million comes through, and that's a big responsibility. And then that scientist has to put together a department to do the actual work, and in doing so, selects people that I'm guessing he believes will work towards the common end of the finding that he wants to demonstrate. So there's a bias right there, you know, selecting the people that will work on this project.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's inevitable that when you're standing there writing down numbers off of Veeder root counters that we used to have on our old relay racks, if you make a mistake occasionally, it's probably in the direction that you want to find your finding to prove.
Yeah. In terms of incentives for cheating, too, I mean, not only is there the situation that you've described, but you've got people who want to get their PhD dissertation, and if they don't have positive findings, they're not likely to get the PhD. I seem to recall that it was pretty explicit that you had to have positive findings.
Well, I'm a perfect example of that. I did a series of studies involving rats and trying to trace a neural pathway from the pineal gland to the eye. And there had already been demonstrated an effect of light on dreaming. And that's where I was headed with my research. But I did a study on, I think it was 5 animals, and it was rejected by my committee as not being enough. The N wasn't large enough. And my advisor, Philip Teitelbaum, was really old school. And his belief was that if you observed something once, it was worthy of further study.
Yeah.
And I had observed it in my 5 subjects, I think 4 out of the 5. But my committee rejected it and told me to go back and do some more research, which sent me to the moon, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to lose it right there and then at the committee meeting. I remember I started to shake kind of uncontrollably, and then I said, oh, well, okay. So it added another year to my already 4 years at the University of Pennsylvania. And then when I... And it involved a collection of EEG data, which in those days was read by hand. In other words, it was you would take your EEG output and run it back through the machine, not to be read, but to be looked at by you visually and scored in real time as it was coming back out of the machine. And so I was looking for REM sleep, and that was pretty easy to spot. And then you would mark it on the actual paper record, and then you would go back later and measure it and so on and so forth. Well, I did another year's worth of research. I had then been hired to teach at the University of Toronto. And so I had to take all of these EEG records with me up to Toronto and then find time in my schedule to run back through an EEG machine and score them. And when I did so, I had no effect. So at the end of 2 years of research, then I was basically at zero. Now, of course, that meant that I wasn't going to get my PhD. And that also meant that if I were to pursue it, I would have to start a new study or a new version of the same study or something like that. I would be starting all over again. And of course, my tenure at the University of Toronto was a 1-year contract, so I knew I wasn't going to stay there. So that meant I was going to have to find a university that would accept me both as a professor and as a student, and somehow get money to run another study of some kind. Well, needless to say, that proved to be impossible.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a good example of what you're saying.
Right. And, think of people who, I could imagine the temptation would have been strong in that situation. It sounds like you didn't do it, but, to fudge the numbers.
I thought about it quite a bit.
With so much on the line.
And imagine,
PhD candidates, I'm sure many, many a one would have fudged the data and has. Guys who are trying to get promoted in academic rank,
Sure.
And then the people with the big grants that you talked about earlier. And, when we were being taught the philosophy of science, this is how it was presented to me, and I'm sure how it was presented to you, was the notion was that scientists are very objective people who will easily discard an idea once they find that their idea, they'll conduct an experiment to test their idea, and if the idea is not borne out, then they will reject that hypothesis, right?
Well, yeah, the question is easily, because if you've invested 5 years of your life into this, it's not going to be easy.
In fact, my observation is that people, once they get their idea, their insight of how they think reality is, they will keep doing the experiment over and over again, finding different ways to come at it until they can finally prove it.
Yeah, in fact, one of my other professors years later said to me that the mistake that I and my advisor had made was that we had not designed the experiment properly so that the outcome would prove something,
mm-hmm.
rather than finding basically no proof of anything.
Yes, right. And that's one of the things they try to drill into graduate students, I think, who are at that level mm-hmm. these days.
Yeah.
And then another source of bias is, and we've kind of touched on this, journals are only interested in positive findings. It's very,
right.
very hard to get something published that is a negative finding.
Yeah, guess what I didn't find.
Yeah, right. We already talked about regression to the mean, which is another source of a problematic thing. In other words, one of the issues is that a standard of an accepted standard in psychology tends to be, we talk about the 5% level of confidence and the 1% level of confidence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the 5% means, okay, we could have gotten a result like this maybe by chance 5 times out of 100.
Mm-hmm.
In the hard sciences, I think maybe 5% is considered too weak. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. True.
In the social sciences, for some reason, it's accepted. But the fact is that you can have something happen by chance, that 1 in 5, that 20%, that 5 times out of 100, or even 1 time out of 100, it could happen that the first time you do your study, that's what happened.
Yeah,
and so
exactly.
you send off to the journal and they publish it and everybody's really happy. And then, and maybe nobody ever tries to, nobody ever really tries to replicate it. And so it becomes part of the canon, or people try to replicate it, but they fail and their failures don't get published.
Yeah, and by the way, when we say cheating, we don't necessarily, at least I don't necessarily mean falsification of data. I told you that story about a scientist that I actually observed doing an experiment that I had been unable to replicate his work. And when I went to his laboratory, and he graciously allowed me to come and watch him, I found that he was entering the experimental chamber and scratching on the side of the cage to entice the rat to come over and press the lever. And that was never reported in his study, but it had a big effect on the outcome. And so that was a form of cheating that really, you know, didn't involve falsifying numbers. It was just like urging the animal to behave in the way that he wanted him to behave.
Right, right. Going through this list of possible sources of bias some more, there's a selective reporting of results. So let's say you do a big study, it's multidimensional, and the tendency is to report the stuff that, you know, was dramatic and positive, and to not even mention the parts of the study that didn't work out.
Right.
Another thing is that fads and fashionability in science. There are fads in science where an idea catches on and it's just really exciting for a time, and then it goes out of fashion.
Yeah. And also the granting agencies tend to ride those fads. You know, what's popular at a given moment may be the thing that NIH wants to fund, and so people are just submitting all kinds of applications for that kind of research. Other stuff that's not quite so popular is not looked into.
Yeah. Then another source of bias is significance changing. That's how he refers to it, which refers to finding ways to interpret the data so that it passes the statistical test of significance. So this is interesting. You know, you'll see people who are sort of doing data mining on their data.
Yeah.
You know, finding like just throwing all these different statistical tests at it or different ways to come at it until you find something that's, you know, that seems to be significant that you can report.
Yes, I saw that once again firsthand at the University of Pennsylvania during my 5 years there as a student, graduate student. The department changed directions and became what they were calling mathematical at the time. They began to do more and more of this sophisticated statistical analysis. To the point that, to be honest with you, I was left behind. I the mathematics of it proved to be too much for my feeble brain. but they were refining their tools to the point that they could find something significant in a random pile of stuff.
You know? Yeah, exactly. And I certainly saw that.
Yeah.
And then on the topic of randomness, there's a researcher by the name of John Crabb, who's a neuroscientist in Oregon. He set out to do a series of experiments on mouse behavior, and he wanted to do the exact same experiment. In other words, I'm going to set this up, so I'm going to make sure that we're doing everything the same. But he did it in three different labs that were in different states, different countries, I think somewhere in the U.S., somewhere in Canada. So he tried to standardize every variable that he could think of.
Yeah, I remember that one because he took the time to order the animals from the same laboratory.
Yeah.
That were even, I think, born on the same day, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
I guess so that's so they would have the same astrological sign or something. I know, but he was very, very careful in trying to replicate it. Yeah.
And he couldn't get the same results. There were differences, you know, between, the randomness, that factor of randomness, or what they call noise, is always going to be there to some extent. And then the last point that I thought was particularly telling is that scientists, like others of us, will cling to ideas. Certain ideas will be, quote, sticky because they, quote, seem to be true.
Right.
You know, oh, it makes sense. This is how the world has to be. Okay, we can't prove it, but, you know, it just makes sense that this is how it should be. And so they just kind of, you know, proceed along those lines.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. In fact, if you've ever found yourself discussing science versus religion, and of course, my argument is, well, you know, religion is purely a belief. Science is not a belief. It's a methodology. It's a way of proceeding. And in truth, they're both belief systems.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We try to convince ourselves that science is not a belief, but the whole structure is a belief.
Yes.
Yeah. It's starting to sound like another segue.
Yeah, it is. And we're going to have a different kind of segue than you're expecting. But,
okay.
But so I'm going to conclude this part about the New Yorker article by just reading the last few sentences that wrap it up. The author says, "The decline effect is troubling because it reminds us how difficult it is to prove anything. Mm-hmm. We like to pretend that our experiments define the truth for us, but that's often not the case. Just because an idea is true doesn't mean it can be proved, and just because an idea can be proved doesn't mean it's true. When the experiments are done, we still have to choose what to believe."
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, here comes the big segue.
All right.
Which is, we have run out of time.
Oh, no.
You're going to love this. So what I'm going to do is wrap up this episode of Shrink Wrap Radio. But you and I are going to keep talking, and it will be the basis for another episode of Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, wow. Okay. Time does fly when I'm talking to you, Dave. I guess that means we're having fun.
I guess so. And I did a lot of the talking this time around, and I think you're going to be doing a lot of the talking next time around. So let me just say thank you to wrap up this segment. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to the continuation.
Okay, Dave, same here. And since this is actually December 31st, I'll wish you a Happy New Year.
Hey, good thought. Happy New Year to you. I hope you enjoyed this conversation between my longtime friend Jerry Trumbull and me. There's always been a special bond between us, and I hope that comes across. I guess I'm also hoping that you find it interesting and that it's not just the two of us getting off on these ideas. I also did not edit this interview in the way I usually do. I left in all our uhs and ums and silences and talkovers on the assumption that it preserves the casual and spontaneous quality of our interaction. Believe me, none of this was rehearsed. If you go to the homepage at shrinkwrapradio.com, you'll find a link to a PDF file of the New Yorker article that was the focus of most of our discussion in this episode. I've also invited the author of that article, Jonah Lerner, to be a guest on the show, but haven't heard back from him. If he does accept, I'm wondering if it would be too redundant given the time we spent going over the article. On the other hand, I think he'd probably be able to provide additional perspective. In the process of our conversation, we discovered that we had more to say than would make sense in a single episode. There are two more topics we'd planned to get to, and so it's looking like there will be two more episodes in this little series. We sincerely hope you find them as meaningful and exciting as we do.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
everybody. Well, I'm into week two of a very persistent cough, so my voice is still not back to what I'd regard as normal. And neither is my energy level. Feels like my brain is moving very slow. I have a very interesting interview up at wisecounselpodcast.com. It's an interview with Ron Kaufman on the Sunrise Program for Autism. He recently stepped down as CEO of the Autism Treatment Center of America. The amazing thing is that he was diagnosed as severely autistic as a child, and then as a result of a treatment approach developed by his parents, he became normal and ended up graduating from Brown University. So Ron was the first recipient of the Sunrise program that was developed by his parents in response to his childhood diagnosis of severe autism. And though his diagnosis was presented by doctors as incurable, his parents, who had recently engaged with the 1970s human potential movement, remained hopeful with the understanding that if they decided the situation was hopeless, it would become so. So they engaged intensively with their son, joining in and participating with his autistic repetitive behaviors, and they did this against medical advice, and they were seeking to create rapport with their son. As Ron began attending to and engaging with his parents, they then used that hook to challenge him and teach him necessary interpersonal and communication skills. So you really need to hear this, as he describes it to me in the Wise Counsel interview. Don't forget, if you need CE units, we have two APA-accredited courses where you can earn your units by listening to these podcasts. One course is on the wisdom of the dream, and the other is on positive psychology and the quest for happiness. While you're on our site, you'll also find links to discounts at Angie's List, 4inkjets.com, and shoebuy.com. My wife's printer just conked out, and so we had to go shopping for another one. She had an older Epson stylus, and I had purchased a bunch of ink cartridges from 4inkjets to have them in reserve. So I had to donate the semi-functional Epson to a local computer recycling center. And I also gave them the new inkjet cartridges that I'd purchased at discount from 4inkjets.com to hold in reserve. This really would have hurt me in the wallet had I not purchased those ink cartridges at such a discount. Giving them to the computer recycling center, I knew that they would get good use by someone. So I got to feel generous, which I must confess was made easier by having bought those cartridges at discount. And you can bet I'll be buying the cartridges for the replacement printer at 4inkjets.com as well. So please go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website so that you too can take advantage of the discounts at Angie's List, 4inkjets.com, and shoebuy.com, thereby saving yourself some money and helping to support this podcast. We have some new transcripts available on the site. Shrink Wrap Radio number 246, Exploring Savant Syndrome with Daryl Treffert, MD, has been transcribed by Renata Silek. Thanks for your dedication and hard work, Renata, and I apologize if I mispronounced your last name. In addition, Shrink Wrap Radio number 255, MindSight with Dr. Daniel Siegel, has been transcribed by Erica Steves. I think that interview is one of my all-time favorites, and so I'm particularly grateful to have that one transcribed. Thank you, Erica Steves. By the way, you might recall my announcing on the last episode two free tickets to the off-Broadway play Freud's Last Session. Our lucky New York City winner is listener Alexei Soma. We'll be looking for a review from Alexei. In the meantime, Freud's Last Session is continuing its February run. Listeners can get discounted tickets by purchasing them online by visiting www.ovationtix.com. That's spelled O-V-A-T-I-O-N-T-I-X.com. or by calling 212-352-3101. Either way, be sure to mention this discount code of MARK11. That's capital M-A-R-K, numeral 1, numeral 1. I should mention that there is a Shrink Wrap Radio Facebook page. Please look for it and, quotes, like it. I'm not enough of a Facebook maven to know exactly what the value of your, quotes, liking it is, but I get all these requests from other people asking me to, quotes, like this or that. I've never asked for this before, but please like me? How pathetic is that? Do be sure to evangelize about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends, colleagues, fellow students, relatives, and, as I say, strangers in the street. I know there's a much larger potential listenership than I've been able to get so far. Also, don't forget to blog and Twitter about your favorite episodes. Finally, let me ask you to pitch in by making a financial donation if you haven't done so already. A relatively small number of people are helping to support this series. Won't you please join them? You'll feel so good exercising your generosity muscles. Just go to our homepage at shrinkwrapradio.com and click on the big green donate button over on the right-hand sidebar. And thanks.
Hi, this is Jerry Trumbull, continuing my inner space explorations in Denver, Colorado. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, my good friend Jerry, who will be back next time for a return visit. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. And actually, I'm going to read just one today. And it's from Gavin in Hawaii, who writes, "Hi, Dave. I've been listening to your show for about 2 years now and have enjoyed all of the episodes a lot. I just finished listening to Dan Siegel's episode on MindSight, and for some reason it prompted me to finally write you a message. I'm currently a grad student in the Department of Second Language Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and that's in Honolulu, studying local language use, Pidgin with a capital P, and Hawaii Creole English in various contexts. The relationship between language and identity has a variety of approaches in the field of second language acquisition, but currently my area is generally referred to as ethnomethodology. I'm writing this because although my research approach is very much oriented towards discursive practices and the way identity is constructed in talk, parentheses, oftentimes taking a cognitive, agnostic, or even anti-cognitive approach to discourse, close parentheses, Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung's writings were the first to spark my intellectual interest in human interaction. I even almost attended Pacifica Graduate School in Carpinteria, California. But through various serendipitous events, I find myself here in Hawaii now. I just thought it would be interesting from a more discursive perspective if you interviewed scholars in the field of discursive psychology. I attached an article on the topic by Derek Edwards, a major researcher in the field of ethnomethodology / conversation analysis / discursive psychology. In the field of linguistics, it seems there is an increasing divide between cognitive approaches and sociological approaches. Maybe addressing this division might be an interesting topic for an interview. Anyway, thanks so much for the podcast. High quality. You ask direct to the point questions while maintaining a fair perspective on the variety of approaches to understanding the human condition. Looking forward to your future podcasts." And 3 exclamation points after that. Aloha and e komo mai if you ever want to come out to Hawaii. If you're interested, it would be great to have you come speak at our university as well. Mahalo. And that's from Gavin, who is a MA candidate in the Department of Second Language Studies. And he notes he's also president of the Second Language Studies Student Association and a graduate assistant in the English Language Institute at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Well, that's a beautiful invitation. I'll have to give that some thought. That would give me a good excuse to travel to Hawaii. Actually, I've never been to that island. I've been to the Big Island of Hawaii, and I've been to Maui, and I've been to Kauai. So, boy, I'm going to have to think about that and think about, well, what would I present on if I were to go there? Would people be interested in hearing me talk about the podcast? Okay, I think I better answer that email. Meanwhile, I have not heard of discursive psychology before or this discursive analysis, and I have yet to read the 18-page PDF that Gavin sent, but I feel a renewed motivation to tackle that. So, Gavin, thanks so much for being a listener and for the invitation to come visit you in Hawaii. And I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, you can send emails to shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave in your comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, or on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my longtime friend, Jerry Trumbull, for the intellectual stimulation of the conversation that you heard today. We're both hoping you found it stimulating as well. We're biting our nails a bit about that, especially since our next show will feature more of the same. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.